The Guardian.
During April, The Guardian's podcasts are partnering with audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/audible to find out more.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
They're hard plastic. They don't really resemble what we think of when we think of rubber ducks.
They're not even rubber.
No. Well, but most rubber ducks, it turns out, aren't.
We're going to meet the author, Donovan Hone. He's been searching for some lost rubber ducks. Well, several thousand of them. It's a search that's led him to chart the seas and hang out with oceanographers. It's all part of his new book, Moby Duck.
The fact that probably most of the people listening to this have never heard of me shows that I'm not the person to give advice on how to have a good reputation.
Also here will be the science writer John Whitfield. He's here to talk about the sociology, economics, philosophy around reputation. We'll also have a chat about this week's news, including gravitational waves and baboons that can understand words, apparently. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. The oceans are as much of a mystery to us today as they've ever been. For sure, we've had centuries to map and explore them, but considering their vast scale, we've barely scratched the surface. With that scale in mind, it seems incongruous that a small plastic bath toy could compel a person to years tracking the movements and currents of the oceans. But that's precisely what happened to the writer Donovan Hone when he heard the story of how 28,800 bath time toys took to the high seas many years ago as a ship's container was thrown overboard in a storm. Donovan wanted to track where these toys, including thousands of ducks, had gone. He came into The Guardian to tell me more. Here he is with a reading from his book, Moby Duck.
Questions, I've learned, can be like ocean currents. Wade in a little too far and they can carry you away. Follow one line of inquiry and it will lead you to another and another. Spot a yellow duck dropped atop the seaweed at the tide line. Ask yourself where it came from. And the next thing you know, you're way out at sea. No land in sight. Dog paddling around in mysteries 4 miles deep. You're wondering when and why yellow ducks became icons of childhood. You want to know what it's like inside the toy factories of Guangdong. You're marveling at the scale of humanity's impact on this terraqueous globe and at the oceanic magnitude of your own ignorance. You're giving the plight of the lace and albatross many moments of thought. The next thing you know, it's the middle of the night and you're on the outer decks of a post-Panamax freighter due south of the Aleutian Island where, in 1741, shipwrecked, Vitus Bering perished from scurvy and hunger. The winds are gale force. The water is deep and black, and so is the sky. It's snowing. The decks are slick. Your ears ache. Your fingers are numb. Solitary, nocturnal circumambulations of the outer decks by supernumerary passengers are strictly forbidden, for good reason. Fall overboard and no one would miss you. You'd inhale the ocean and go down alone. Nevertheless, there you are, not a goner yet, gazing up at the shipping containers stacked six high, and from them cataracts of snowmelt and rain are spattering on your head. There you are, listening to the stacked containers strain against their lashings, creaking and groaning and cataracting with every roll. And with every roll you are wondering what in the name of Neptune it would take to make stacks of steel, or for that matter aluminum, containers fall. Or you're learning how to tie a bowline knot and say thank you in both Inuktitut and Cantonese.
Donovan, you've just described in a short passage from the prologue of your book some moments when you were on a boat in the middle of some sea. How did you find yourself there? What was the journey to get to that point of what sounds like quite a terrifying introspective moment?
That moment in some way was one I'd been imagining since I first heard of this story of the bath toys lost at sea. When I stumbled on the story in 2005, I think one of the first things I tried to picture was the moment that their journey on the currents began. I'd never heard of container ships losing containers overboard, and I'd never been in rough seas, you know. So trying to picture that day or night, out in the stormy latitudes of the North Pacific, and what it would have been like on that ship was something that I had in my head for years at that point. So the notion for the book was to try to almost reenact the journey of the toys, follow their trail, go adrift myself. Luckily, not overboard myself. You know, I wasn't going to take it literally. But so that's that. Those details in that passage that I read were describing a night when I was on a container ship. I managed to get myself on board a ship even larger than the one that lost the toys, but same notion, that was traveling the same route from the Far East to the North Pacific, and I went out against the rules onto the outer decks, again, trying to imagine what it was like. We were in a snowstorm at that moment, and it was about the roughest the weather got on that journey. So I wanted to experience it as thoroughly as I could.
And it was possibly a similar night back in 1992 that the container ship that starts your interest actually went through a storm, and a few lines of containers fell off. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so January 10th, 1992, just south of the Aleutian Islands, near the international dateline, way out in the middle of the Pacific, but at the northern extreme of it, this ship, and for mysterious reasons, but we do know the conditions were rough, managed to lose two stacks of containers, 12 of them, overboard, and from one of them escaped this shipment of bath toys. You know, they were in boxes, and they were highly buoyant, and I've seen photos of other container spills, and they kind of crumple fairly easily as if they do chance to fall. And so these boxes escaped onto the North Pacific, and the water dissolved the glue of the boxes, and these toys eventually hatched from their packages and began riding the currents.
So 29,000, there's sometimes all mislabeled as rubber ducks, but there's actually a variety of species there.
Yeah. No, you hear the story. I mean, the headlines over the years were typically rubber ducks lost at sea. I went through the trouble to pin down all the details. It was 28,800 plastic bath toys. There were four to each package, and 7,200 packages, and they came in four varieties. There were the ducks were the famous ones, of course, but there were also green frogs, blue turtles, and my favorite, red plastic beavers. They're hard plastic. They don't really resemble what we think of when we think of rubber ducks.
They're not even rubber.
No. Well, but most rubber ducks, it turns out, aren't. The ones that feel like rubber are actually PVC with softeners added. But these ones don't even feel like rubber.
So you'd be forgiven for thinking that if something goes overboard in the middle of a storm, lost to sea forever, you know, you scratch it away off your manifest list and move on. But 11 years later, these animals start to turn up on shores.
They actually started turning up later that same year. They made it in by the fall of 92. They had begun making landfall in and around Sitka, Alaska, which is directly across the Gulf of Alaska. It's down in the southeastern portion of the state, kind of in the vicinity of Vancouver, just north of Vancouver, and along a stretch of coastline, a couple hundred miles. Suddenly, as if magically, these bath toys of in four different colors, and beachcombers were finding them everywhere. So that's where they first made landfall, and that's actually in some ways where the fable of the rubber ducks lost at sea began, because there was a local newspaper there did a story on it for I think obvious reasons. Yeah.
And so when did sort of more serious scientists get involved? Because this is what we're interested in.
Right.
Oceanographers are, you might think that it's just a curiosity, but oceanographers actually are looking at these things and using them in computer models.
Well, what happened was that there was an oceanographer by the name of Curtis Absmeyer in Seattle, a professional oceanographer, had studied eddies in the Gulf of Mexico and studied the currents in and around Puget Sound to study sewage outflows, all sorts of professional science, in his case, mostly for engineering projects. And later in his career, in his kind of semi-retirement and then on into his retirement, he had this notion he'd heard of in 1990, actually, of a shipment of Nike sneakers that fell overboard. And it occurred to him, well, this is in fact very similar to what oceanographers used to do by design. They would go off in the 19th century and you know, chuck messages in bottles or kegs, or things that stamped with a return address, so that if beachcombers found them, they could report back, and you'd have actually some data points that would help you chart the currents. And so it occurred to him that here was this potentially free windfall of data. You know, it required some investigation on his part. You had to find out where the toys went overboard for it to be meaningful, or where the shoes went overboard. So you had to get the shipping companies to divulge the coordinates of the spill. And then you had to reach out to beachcombers and lighthouse keepers, anyone who might have found them. And so, as it happens, things like when hundreds of Nikes begin washing in, people enjoyed finding them, and it wasn't that hard for him to begin collecting that data. And likewise, the toys, I think in some ways they're perfect for this, because people find them delightful and they're colorful. So they tend to notice them, they tend to collect them. And so slowly he began to have a kind of a data set.
And so these toys turned up in Alaska, but also they started turning up all over the place, and not just there. And I mean, what do these data points start to tell oceanographers? What are they interested in examining from them?
Yeah, well, I mean, the major currents of the oceans were charted in the 19th century. The Gulf Stream was actually sketched by Benjamin Franklin. So, but they really kind of came into focus, the major currents, by the end of the 19th century, using the same method of casting drifters overboard. And you know, it can tell you the I think that one of the reasons why it's still of interest is that the currents turn out to be a bit more mysterious than people sometimes imagine. It's even there in the name Gulf Stream suggests that it's like a river, right? And they have been compared to rivers in the sea. And it turns out that, you know, unlike rivers, they don't have banks, and they meander and change. And in a way, they're more analogous to the winds. And in fact, one of the things I came to appreciate over the course of my research is that there really is the water is some oceanographers have referred to the oceans as the hydrosphere. It's a watery counterpart to the atmosphere. And just like the atmosphere, it has a climate, it has weather. There's a weather of the sea, and like the weather of the atmosphere, it's difficult to predict, and the climate is difficult to predict. So in fact, that since currents change, more slowly than the winds do, but they still change and shift for complicated reasons, chaotic reasons, that there is a use in an ongoing mapping of them.
And so in a normal sense, in modern times, how do oceanographers actually map these things? I mean, they're not chucking bath toys overboard from their research vessels, I'm assuming.
Well, no. For the most part, no.
Some parts, yes.
Well, actually, I wanted to go to the Arctic, since there was this part of the story for the toys was that they were predicted, some of them, to have entered the Bering Strait and gone to the Arctic. And I went aboard. I joined a group of scientists conducting research using a Canadian Coast Guard icebreaker. And in fact, part of the way I got myself onto that research cruise was by volunteering to assist in a drift experiment using messages in bottles. So my job was to get up at preordained hours, sometimes in the middle of the night, though it looked like day because we were in the Arctic, and carry a box loads of these beer bottles corked up with messages in them. There'd been a teenage Nova Scotian girl who was a bit of an oceanography geek like me, who'd volunteered to scroll these things up, but she was too young to actually go on the ship, so I was basically her proxy, and I would throw these bottles overboard, you know, dozens at a time, and then mark down exactly when and where they'd gone adrift, and it partly that's, you know, I think that there's the messages in bottles capture people's imagination. It's a useful way for scientists to make their work of interest and understandable to the general public, but it actually is of some value because in the Arctic, the conditions there are so inhospitable that using the sorts of high-tech equipment that oceanographers will tend to use now in southern latitudes is harder. It's more expensive. It's harder to deploy instruments up there. It's harder to retrieve them. The ice conditions can be brutal. Typically, in southern latitudes, they use floats that are they're almost like underwater robots. They can ascend and descend the water column. They have a kind of an air bladder that makes them go up and down, and they can sense what's happening around them. They're smart weather balloons of sorts, and they can surface and beam data back to shore. All of that gets harder to do if, when they surface, there's ice, skin of ice at the surface of the sea. It's harder for them to communicate. So for those reasons, this 19th century old-fashioned crude way of collecting data on the currents is still of some use.
I don't want to spoil the ending of Moby Dick for people who haven't maybe read it, but did you find your yellow ducks, and did you find the salvation you needed?
You know, I did. I mean, in a way, as I say early on, it was meant to be. I wanted it to be a kind of a voyage of discovery. Not that I was going to go off and discover undiscovered lands. There are none of those really left anymore. But that it would be for me a journey of discovery. I would discover things about the ocean and about cargo ships, which I think are mysterious to most of us. We're unaware of them. And about factories in China. So it was that for me. But it also was a genuine pursuit. I mean, in a way, it's for those who know Moby Dick, I mean, you're chasing the white whale, but then there's Ishmael's also trying to understand the white whale. There's a pursuit of the meanings of the whale. And the book does kind of both of those things, but I did genuinely go off all over the Northern Hemisphere hunting these toys. And I did succeed in finding a couple of them in the Alaskan wilderness in the wild in 2007. I went up there because I'd heard there was a group of well-intentioned but perhaps quixotic conservationists who had made it their mission to clean up a remote, uninhabited, half-mile stretch of shoreline in the Alaskan wilderness that, like, you can find these places around the world. The shape of the land and the direction of the currents and the winds means that flotsam will pile up by the ton. And since no one's out there, it's a very inaccessible place to go. You have to go by boat or helicopter. It just stayed there for years. It was kind of this accidental midden heap that the currents had formed, and they were going to clean it up. But they were. I'd heard through the grapevine that they had begun finding the toys. So I got myself on a plane and then on a boat and out into the wilds of Alaska, where for 3 days I sorted through flotsam a yard deep, and on one of those days, to my great delight, found it was actually a plastic beaver at the foot of a spruce tree. And one of the people out there had mercy. They found these toys were turning up, dozens of them. One of them gave me a duck, so I didn't go home empty-handed. I had a duck, too.
Donovan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Moby Duck, the story of 28,800 bath toys lost at sea, is published by Union Books and is out now. Let's take a look now at some of the big science news stories this week. Joining me to do exactly that is science writer John Whitfield. Hello, John. And the Observer's science editor, Robin McKee. Welcome to you both. John, we're going to start with you. Apparently, baboons are about to take over the world. Or did I read that incorrectly?
Well, they might be about to take over your job, but I don't think they're about to take over the world.
I think one of them has already done it. I won't interrupt. Go on.
So, yes, this is a paper that's been published in Science this week, in which a group of French researchers have taught baboons the rules that we use to recognize what makes up an English word and what is a non-word. So they used free-living baboons and gave them a kind of touchscreen multiple choice test, where in their enclosure they saw they were presented with either a real word, all four-letter words such as vast, or a made-up non-word randomly generated, so something like dran or telk were some of the ones they used. And they found that over time the baboons were surprisingly good at working out which was a real word and which wasn't. They got to about 75%, 80% accuracy over the course of the trials.
Was it only with words that they'd been familiarised with, or could they recognise new words?
Well, yeah. Yes, in the trials, they did teach them new words, but they also found that as they went on, the baboons got increasingly good at distinguishing words from non-words at first glance. And so, for example, the non-words that were most like real words were misidentified more commonly than real words. So it looks as if instead of just learning what an individual word looks like, they're actually learning the rules that we use to distinguish, to recognise a word.
This is interesting. So what does it tell us about the evolution of language, I suppose? I mean, they make conclusions on that front?
Yeah, what they claim is that, according to the paper, this isn't a debate I'm familiar with, but the... Most people have thought that reading is an extension of language. So when we learn to turn written symbols into sounds and meaning, we use the same things that we use in speech. But obviously baboons don't talk. So what the researchers behind this study suggest is that, in fact, it's just pattern recognition, that they can recognise and learn to interpret what's called orthographic information. So the visual shape of words and the position of letters between them and the letter combinations that recur most commonly in real words versus non-words. And that just as one might recognise a chair by the fact that it's got four legs and a back, you can recognise a word by its visual shape rather than tapping into any higher level linguistic processing.
Robin?
I mean, absolutely fascinating paper. I've got one thing that really puzzles me. French researchers, but they used English words. No, I mean,
would the Académie Française say?
They're going to go berserk when they see that.
Yeah, I guess so. Maybe, I don't know. I'm not an expert on French. I don't know how many four-letter words French has. And the lead author is called Jonathan Granger, which suggests that French is not his first language.
Ah, yes, but. Yes, yes.
So how soon before the baboon starts to read and make science and that kind of thing?
Well, one of the interesting things about this paper is that most of the baboons, so they use six baboons, and the five of them managed to learn within the worst one learned 85 words, and the second best baboon learned 125 words, I think it was. But the best learned 308 out of the 500
Wow.
words. So there's this super baboon somewhere that's probably already got a Twitter account. And
they have a subs department, yeah. I suspect.
Robin, let's move on to you. You're going to talk about something much more universal, gravitational waves. Tell us how close we are to... Well, tell us what they are first, and then how close we are to finding
them. Gravitational waves are... predicted by Einstein's general theory of relativity and basically massive objects or events such as supernovae or neutron star collisions disrupt the space-time curvature and produce these ripples that we spread across the universe.
And so they're actually this space-time sort of moving around.
It moves about in response to it. And it's a great idea. Einstein predicted that these would happen, but he also predicted that we would never see them because they were too remote and too dissipated ever to be observed on Earth. So these guys building detectors in Germany and in America and other places, they're basically trying to prove Einstein right and wrong. Right, that he was, that they existed, but wrong that we can't detect them.
And you've written about this week in The Observer. What is the experiment you focused on?
This is a place called GEO 600, a place in Ruth, in outside Hanover. It's the smallest of the sort of major detectors. There are bigger ones, two bigger ones in America and one in Italy. And basically you've got sort of 600 refers to 600 metre arms that these tunnels in which the detectors are built. They're built at right angles to each other, two arms. And as a gravitational wave comes in, it dislodges, it lengthens one and shortens the other arm. And you try and detect that. The trouble is that the change in size of those arms is something like 1 to 10 to the minus 20 metres. That's about smaller than the diameter of a proton. And you've got to try and detect that, to use that laser interferometry to do that. But you're bedeviled by all the sorts of things, like in the detector in Germany, just the pounding of the sea, that on the waves in the North Sea is enough to produce an effect. If you walk past it, your own gravitational mass, the mass of your body, produces a slight gravitational effect that again distorts the instruments. So basically they have just been working, trying to get rid of all this seismic interference, as they call it. And they think they've done it, but the instrument, the arms probably on the German detector are still too small. So they're shipping all the equipment that they've developed in Germany to the detectors in America. And within 2 or 3 years, they say we'll get gravitational waves. I've got to say that in the 10 years or 15 years I've been talking to gravitational wave physicists, they've always said it's two or three years' time.
It's a bit like nuclear fusion, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's always 40. Well, nuclear fusion is always 40 years away, whatever point in time you're at. Gravitational waves, you're right. Every time you speak to them, they're going to be in 2 or 3 years' time.
Yes.
I spoke to some gravitational wave researchers, I think, in Germany about 6 years ago, and they said, oh, yeah, yeah, 2 or 3 years, two or three years. There is actually several, there are several bets on, aren't there, to try and find these things. I mean, I know that some scientists up in Glasgow, I think.
The Glasgow guys are the guys that are working with the German.
Yeah, so they'd bet that it was going to be by 2010. Clearly, that's not happened.
No.
Yeah,
and they say 2015 now, but yeah, I wouldn't put your money on it. But still, I mean, it's going to happen one day.
What happens when we find them? What does it help us do?
It helps us look at the universe for the first time and not using electromagnetic radiation. Because the picture we have of the universe is entirely built up of gamma rays, infrared, visible light. It's a new way of doing it. If you have several detectors around the world, you can triangulate and you can actually source the origins of these gravitational waves. And then from the vibrations, from the actual wavelength and intensities, you can actually study the internal structure of objects that are producing these. So it's a new way of looking at the universe.
I mean, there are experiments like looking for gravitational waves planned for space as well.
Yes, this is LIGO. But the Americans have pulled out of that for the moment.
Very expensive, I assume.
Very expensive. And there you don't have the trouble with your arms of your device being limited to a few kilometres. You can have hundreds and thousands of kilometres for your arms because you just have two satellites at the end. You don't build a tunnel or anything like that. But that requires an incredible amount of precision in space. But yes, I mean, people are the European Space Agency is actively planning it. NASA, I think, is kind of on hold on that one, as it is with so many other projects at the moment.
Okay. Well, let's move on to our third topic for discussion today, which is a bit of a meta topic, science topic. It's open access in scientific publishing. This is a story that we did in The Guardian last week. It's not new to any of us around the table, and probably not so many of the scientists who listen. But it was certainly news to... let's say non-science specialists on our news desk that actually most of the world's scientific research, which is publicly funded, it sits behind paywalls in publishing companies. And it was news to them that the peer review system was sort of done by academics for free, that the work that if you, Robin, get £5 million from some research council to look for gravitational waves, you find them, you want to publish them in Nature, which is one of the top journals in the world. The Nature sort of take your submission, they send it out to peer reviewers in the same field. Maybe the guys in Glasgow will look over it for free, send it back, and then Nature publish it. And it then appears on their website with their sort of stamp of approval. But you have to then pay to subscribe to it, which seems like a sensible-ish model, except that some publishing companies, and there are lots of them, and there are thousands of journals, charge vast amounts of money for access to this research, which essentially we've paid for anyway. There was a boycott of one of the big publishing companies, Elsevier, that started up a few months ago, where scientists have publicly said they're not going to review for or submit to or take editorial work for Elsevier journals. Elsevier, I'm using just as an example. There are many other publishing companies, but they happen to be the biggest ones, so they're the targets of this boycott. And they're arguing that, look, taxpayers have funded this research in the first place. Taxpayers fund the salaries of the reviewers, and then taxpayers have to provide money for the researchers to access their own research. It seems like a very silly system, and it seems like academics kind of go along with it because they're concerned about, you know, reputation, they're concerned about getting money for future grants, and that's all tied up in where you publish. This is the beginning of lots of stories on this, hopefully for us. Like I said at the beginning, here in this room, probably it's not so much of a surprise. But do you think that the recent stuff that's happening, the boycotts, the movement for open access on the web, and the way the web is actually changing the way science is done, do you think this is going to have any impacts in this debate? Because we've kind of had these things before. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there were boycotts for big journals, and you had the launch of open access journals. I mean, John, you used to work at Nature. So, I mean, you've seen these sorts of things before. Is anything changing?
Well, there's certainly a large open access ecosystem now that's grown up. So if scientists want to publish in journals that can be read without anyone paying a subscription fee, then it's possible for them to do so. But that hasn't really replaced the paid-for journals so far. Rather, it almost represents an extra expense, because open access journals typically charge the authors to publish in them, and that's how they make their money.
That's
rather
right.
than charging subscribers to read them. And so that's almost an extra drain. If you're still subscribing to all the paid-for journals, but you're having to pay for open access journals, then that's kind of where we are at the moment.
Well, that's the model, isn't it? Open access is what the campaigners, or the ones who are most exercised about this, want, and there are several ways of doing this, as John says. But also, in all of this time, of course, library budgets, research budgets are all going down. So there is an argument to say, look, perhaps some publishing companies are making far too much money. I mean, some of the bigger ones with thousands of journals make 30 or 40% profit margins on this stuff. And this is all
good
publicly
lord, a publisher
funded.
Making money. Oh, God. Keep your voice down.
In some of the articles I wrote, actually, there were some comments saying, The Guardian makes no money, now you want to take everyone else down as well. It's a good point. It's a good point.
Yes.
But it's something that I think will run and run. And one of our editorial leader writers actually wrote about this last week, saying that it was a very silly system that a lot of very clever people have put up with for too much time. Now, whether that's a sort of slightly simplistic way of looking at it, hopefully the discussion will be had and maybe something better will come out of it in the next few years. It does require, however, scientists to sort of get off their high horse slightly and not want to publish in massively important, impactful journals. John, we'll talk about reputations a bit later. But this is all tied up around that, isn't it? It's all
yes.
tied up around scientific reputation.
Yes.
Because that's the way you make your next research grant.
Yes. And you want your stuff in Nature.
And that's one of the way that journals make their money and justify charging for things, is that they are an imprimatur of quality, and that once you have Nature or Science or Cell attached to your name, that's actually worth paying for because of the benefit that'll do your career.
That's right, and the research grants then flow in. I think that's how it works, isn't it?
I think it does. I mean, yeah, I don't think it's complicated.
All right, John, Robin, thank you very much for all of that. For more on all this stuff, please go to guardian.co.uk/science. John Whitfield is still here with us. John, now the reason we have you on this podcast, and we've had you on before, is that we know you're a good talker. Your reputation precedes you. In fact, we're all working on reputation far more than we think. Now, lucky for us, John has just brought out a book called People Will Talk, The Surprising Science of Reputation. So you can hopefully take us through some of this stuff in a much more rigorous way than just gossiping. John, tell us, what is reputation, and is it actually possible to study scientifically? I mean, you do say in your book it is the byproduct of gossip.
It is. Well, human reputation is, your reputation is produced by what you do, but more particularly by what other people say about you behind your back. And the fact that we were talking about language a little earlier, the fact that we're a linguistic species lets us exchange and spread social information in a way that no other species has managed. And that's what reputation is made of. It's a product of language almost.
And so when you started to look at this in your book, it's one of those subjects which you can look at from many different lenses. I mean, economics, philosophy, literature, evolutionary biology. Let's start with the last one first. What is the point of it, evolutionarily speaking? Is it all about trust?
Yes, it's about enabling cooperation, because cooperation is a very powerful thing. And any species that can achieve that in nature tends to be a real success story, if you think about social insects like ants and bees. But cooperation is also very vulnerable to cheating, because if you've got a group of cooperators, then you can get a free rider who will take the benefits without paying the costs. And if you get, and that gives them an advantage, so you get more of them, but that ultimately leads to the collapse of the cooperative group. So cooperation needs ways to defend itself, just as a multicellular body of all these cooperating cells needs to defend itself against bacteria and viruses that see it as a resource to be exploited rather than a common resource to be contributed to. And reputation is what we use to defend cooperation. It's the way we can reward good behaviour and punish bad behaviour and reap the benefits of working together.
Okay, so let's go through some examples. In the book, you have sort of very intriguing parallels you make between different groups of people. So tell us, first of all, why, for example, in traditional societies, for thousands of years, gods have had many, many eyes. Why are eyes important?
Well, H.L. Mencken, the American journalist and satirist of the early 20th century, said that conscience is the sense of that someone's watching you. And that's true to an extent. We all behave differently when we're being watched, and we're very sensitive. Even a picture of some eyes on a wall will make us more generous and more cooperative and more honest. And one way to outsource this, if you like, is to have supernatural surveillance. And obviously the idea of an all-powerful God who knows everything and who will punish you for all eternity if you do the wrong thing is a very powerful incentive to behave well, and possibly also stop you from doing anything that will ruin your earthly reputation as well. So ideas of surveillance are very common in religions throughout the world. There's the many heads or the many eyes of gods in Hinduism, and there's even in religions which don't encourage images of their gods, like Christianity and Islam, there's references to divine scrutiny in scripture, in the Quran, in the Book of Common Prayer, in the Bible. There's always, religion is always encouraging this sense that you're being watched and judged.
I love the fact that you've reduced gods to an outsourcing of reputation management. That's wonderful. Let's go on to another example. You've drawn a parallel between psychopaths and MPs who fiddle their expenses. Now, I want to believe this, so tell me what the how you get there.
So, well, one of the properties of being a psychopath, one of the things that makes them unusual, is that they don't care what other people think of them. They don't have much empathy, and they are not concerned about other people's opinions. And that many evolutionary psychologists will see that as a feature rather than a bug, because it lets you, we were talking about viruses and bacteria earlier, that is a good adaptation for exploiting other people's social behaviour, because most people aren't like that and most people will cooperate with you. But they'll only cooperate with you as an opening gambit. And if you don't cooperate with them back, then your reputation will be ruined and you'll have to move on. And one of the features of people with psychopathic personalities is they tend to be drifters. They move around a lot and they're not pinned down. They have very low boredom thresholds and they move on. So what they try to do is they try to open up social distance. And similarly, anywhere, most of us aren't psychopaths, but if we find ourselves across large social distances from other people, then we are more wont to treat them badly. That's one of the things that undermines cooperation. And so wherever you see bad behaviour, it tends to be in very tight-knit, isolated communities where people don't know what's going on outside. So MP's expenses system was secret for a long time, and they fought to keep it that way. And because no one knew about it, there was no reputational cost with abusing that. And it became the norm within that group of community, that group of people, because everyone was doing it, to fiddle your expenses.
They thought they'd never be caught.
Well, they just forgot about the possibility of being caught, it seems. And they forgot that what they were doing was wrong, in the same way that the financial community is quite cut off from the rest of society. And that was probably one of the factors that led them to cause the economic damage that they did a few years ago, and is one of the factors that is causing them to carry on awarding themselves bonuses and resist reforms. Or you might look at the news international journalists stuck out there in Wapping, all in a tight-knit community, very sort of tribal in a way, that builds up its own norms, but which are at odds with the wider society.
Sounds a bit like
groupthink,
doesn't it? All of that. If you're within a group of people who all think the same, you're your own morals or your own value systems that you might have had if you didn't know those people, they sort of meld together with the group, and you end up sort of thinking like them and thinking that's completely normal.
That's right, because the people you're closest to are the people you depend on for their help and their support, and so it's only natural that you come to share those attitudes.
It's reputation is not actually what we use to measure each other, it's what we use to control each other. So how am I controlling you with your reputation?
So, well, the fact that if, say, I do a terrible job on this podcast and then you can go and tell everyone how rubbish I am, and that will affect my future prospects. So that is a powerful incentive to me to behave in a certain way. The philosopher Robert Axelrod called reputation the shadow of the future. And one way you can look at reputation is it's a way of bringing the future to bear on the present and influence our current behaviour by our concerns about how we'll be treated in the future.
Just finally, do you have any tips for our listeners? How to trust people more? How to be trustworthy? Can you manipulate them?
All the time I've been writing this book, I've had to beat back the notion that it's a self-help manual. And so I am not the person. The fact that probably most of the people listening to this have never heard of me shows that I'm not the person to give advice on how to have a good reputation. But basically, be nice and be friendly. Because if you do, you need to do good things, but you also need to know that you also need other people to know that you've done good things. One of the people I quote in the book said, if you do good work and people don't talk about it, you have the life expectancy of morning dew. So it's that
you have to be self-promoting. Brilliant. This is exactly this. We end up always on Twitter. You have to be on Twitter and tweeting about yourself all the time, too. John, thank you very much for that. Well, that's it for this week's show. Thanks to John Whitfield and to Robin McKee. John's book, People Will Talk, The Surprising Science of Reputation, is published by John Wiley & Sons, and it's available now. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
During April, The Guardian's podcasts are partnering with audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/audible to find out more.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.